Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There was just no seeing eye to eye in Washington today. It was more like in your face, nose to nose, as the federal government braced for a shutdown. The Senate's top Democrat used the word shameful to describe the stalemate, while the Republican leader fired back that the other side should get serious. You tell me, does that sound anywhere close to compromise? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Pro Online Backup, the automatic backup solution designed for small businesses. Learn more at carbonitepro.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal on what's looking more and more like the eve of a federal shutdown. Thanks for making us a part of your Friday this April 8th. Just two words tell the story of the hour. No progress. We're only hours away from a government shutdown, which will have serious consequences for financial operations throughout the country. Our D.C. Bureau Chief John Dimsdale is here. Hey, John.
Hey, Bob.
First off, this being Marketplace, I'm wondering what's going to happen to the financial cops on the beat when the government closes up shop?
Well, there are two different types of regulators. Those that are funded through user fees paid by businesses don't have to rely on the federal budget. So that means business as usual at bank regulators like the Federal Reserve or the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. But the Securities and Exchange Commission is another story. They oversee stocks and bonds, and those employees will be furloughed. Now, all the routine filings and reports that companies are required to submit to the SEC will continue. That's all done electronically these days. But nothing is going to be done with those filings. I talked today to a former SEC staffer who was there during the last shutdown back in 1996. Jim Maloney is now a partner at Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher in Los Angeles, and he says the backlog will quickly become a problem.
That computer system is just full of filings which have not been assigned to reviewers. And so there's a little bit of digging out, if you will, from sort of the snowstorm of paper that has come in while the government employees have been home.
So that means companies that want to issue new stocks and bonds or maybe put a question to shareholders at an upcoming annual meeting are going to have to wait for a regulatory approval.
John, what about SEC investigations into wrongdoing? Are they going to keep tabs on the bad guys?
Investigations that are at some vital stage, say, for example, the bad guy is just about to get away with the money, those are going to continue. SEC lawyers will meet their court dates. But, you know, all the time that there are companies trying to pump up their stock prices with false earnings statements or bogus announcements, and Maloney says without the SEC around, there's potential for a lot more fraud.
And as an investor, you just want to be more on guard. Sort of if you're walking in a neighborhood and the police are not there, you'd probably be more cautious as to looking at who's behind you and who's on the other side of the street.
So how else are companies going to miss the government, John?
If you're an airplane maker and you're looking for government approval of some new design, the federal aviation officials aren't going to be answering their phones. And if you rely on government statistics, those reports like trade figures or weekly unemployment claims or the inflation numbers, you're going to be out of luck.
Gee, John, this sounds pretty bad. Is there any good news out there at all?
Well, I'm looking forward to a quick and easy commute on Monday.
Our D.C. Bureau Chief John Dimsdale, thanks.
Thanks, Bob.
As we always say, Wall Street hates uncertainty. Details when we do the numbers. It's Friday, and that means it's time to look back on the week that was. And it was, and still is, all about the budget. As we just discussed, no deal has been reached yet in D.C. on federal spending for this year. To do the weekly wrap on Wall Street and beyond, we have Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal and Lizzie O'Leary from Bloomberg. Greetings to you both.
Hi.
Hi, Bob.
So, Sudeep, did you ever think it would come to this?
I really didn't think it would come to this because this impasse is really over the loose change in the budget, a few billion dollars out of a few trillion. And so this was really a political game of chicken, but it really foreshadows something that's much more dangerous, this battle that's coming up on raising the debt ceiling. And if you're an investor in the debt markets, the political environment now looks a little bit riskier today than it did a week ago. And so what we've learned from all of this, whether the government shuts down or not, is that we are in a much different political environment that could start weighing on markets and the economy.
So that said, would you say this is more ideological or financial, Lizzie?
Well, the Republicans say it's financial and the Democrats say it's ideological, and they're probably both not telling the entire truth. If you could put a price on what is essentially a little piece of policy about Planned Parenthood, that might solve this problem, because numerically the two parties aren't that far apart in terms of the cuts they want, and they are both politically playing to their base, and Sudeep is right, that they're both getting ready for some much bigger fights, so digging in their heels now they think helps them in the future.
Is that really what this is all about, just Planned Parenthood, Sudeep?
This is really about the size and shape of the federal government, and that's why there are people digging in their heels over something that's a few billion dollars right now in such a large budget. And if they can make their point, even if they take this to the 11th hour and get their point across that they're willing to do what it takes to get their side to win, then it's a victory for either side. And that's why they're both willing to push it to the end at this point.
Lizzie, who's not moving here? I mean, I thought there was a number that it was agreed to, and then the target changed.
The target may have changed. I think what's going on is that you have leadership in both parties who've been in Congress for a while, and then there's also a question of these new folks who came in precisely on a plan to cut spending and a promise to do that. And some of what's going on is John Boehner going back to his Republican colleagues and saying, all right, well, if I can get this much out of the Democrats, will you go along with that? Because they all know that the 2012 budget is going to be a much bigger fight, because we are basically talking about less than 0.2% of the budget right now. It's kind of mind-boggling what a fraction is doing to the pace of government.
$30 billion, $60 billion. I mean, is the fight worth shutting down the government, Sudeep?
It certainly isn't over that small amount of money. But the bigger issue is, how far are you willing to go for what you believe in politically? The risk, though, is that if you do create a shutdown in the government, and it's a shutdown that lasts more than just a couple of days, the economy is going to take some small hit. And as time goes on, it's going to take a larger hit. And this is a moment where the recovery is fairly fragile. And with all the problems in Japan, in Europe, in the Middle East, in North Africa, creating a new problem of our own making is just not very wise at this point.
Back up just a little bit. Lizzie, $30 billion, $60 billion, that really isn't a small amount of money, or is it?
It's not a small amount of money by any means, but in comparison to a $3.7 trillion budget, it is. And right now, when we're talking about whether or not they can agree on, say, $38.5 billion or $40 billion, then we really are talking about loose change. And in terms of the economic impact, we are sort of in slightly uncharted waters, because the 90s were a very different time than this is. That the impact on consumer confidence, the impact on housing could be very different and very real if there is a shutdown that goes on for a couple of weeks.
We are in uncharted waters. The truer words were never spoken. Lizzie O'Leary from Bloomberg and Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
It had all the makings of a very gloomy gathering. European finance ministers met in Hungary today to talk about the third bailout in a row for a heavily in debt eurozone country. After Greece and then Ireland, it was Portugal's turn this week to beg for financial help. But today's meeting was upbeat. Many of those EU ministers insist Europe's debt crisis now under control. As Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London, not everyone shares that optimism.
The Spanish finance minister was adamant. At today's meeting, she declared, "The crisis is over. The contagion's been stopped in its tracks." She said it is out of the question that Spain would need bailing out next. Ward McCarthy of Jefferies Investment Bank.
We would love to think that the debt crisis ends with Portugal. But again, the markets are not going to believe that it's ended until they actually see some hard numbers to support that contention.
EU ministers point to yesterday's Spanish government bond sales. They went very well. But economist Andrew Hilton says that to really get itself out of trouble, Spain needs growth. And that remains elusive.
The government has just cut its economic growth forecast for this year and next, and unemployment itself is continuing to rise. And I don't think the Spanish are out of the woods yet.
And Simon Tilford of the Centre for European Reform says Spain and other heavily indebted countries on the periphery of Europe have just been dealt another blow, this week's hike in interest rates by the European Central Bank.
There's no doubt it's going to have a negative impact. I mean, the last thing the peripheral states need at the moment is a tightening of monetary policy. That will push up further the cost of borrowing for governments, push up the cost of households' mortgages. It's the last thing they need.
Few analysts predict that Spain will be the next domino to fall, but very few share the minister's confidence that Europe's debt crisis is over. Many believe the problem may linger well into this year. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up...
The Home Depot is the world's largest home improvement specialty retailer in the world, I mean, by far, and we plan to be number one in China, too.
Why that may not be as easy as it sounds. But first, let's do the numbers. All three major indexes took a shave today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average nicked off 29 points, 0.25%, to end at 12,380. The Nasdaq wiped away 15 points, or 0.5%, to close at 2780. The S&P 500 parted with 5 points, 0.4%, to finish at 1328. For the week, the Dow stood in place. The Nasdaq lost 0.3%. So did the S&P 500. Crude oil futures ended above $112 a barrel for the first time since September 2008. United Airlines lost altitude of 5.75%. Just think, the world's biggest airline burns $25,000 worth of fuel a minute, and fuel is headed up. AMR, parent of American Airlines, clipped its wings by 4.5%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Pro Online Backup, the automatic backup solution designed for small businesses. Carbonite Pro automatically backs up computer files to a secure location with anytime, anywhere access from any computer or smartphone. Learn more at carbonitepro.com. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at the events for Monday. The IMF puts out its World Economic Outlook with analysis of economic developments around the globe. If you're a Florida student getting ready for the state's Comprehensive Assessment Test, or FCAT, fuel up at McDonald's. The chain's restaurants are offering free breakfast. No McNuggets before 11, though. Annie decked out First Lady Jackie Kennedy. The late designer Oleg Cassini was born in 1913. I'm Megan Larson.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Let's try a quick word association exercise. When I say secret bank account, what country comes to mind? I'm guessing the most popular answer is likely to be Switzerland. If I mention offshore tax haven, I'll venture the survey says the Cayman Islands. Your thoughts probably didn't turn right away to India, but today there's word the IRS is investigating Indian Americans for tax evasion. Here's Marketplace's Jeff Tyler.
The IRS wants banking giant HSBC to share information about people evading taxes through accounts in India. In a statement, HSBC says it has complied with laws in all the countries where it operates. Clients, on the other hand, might not have declared bank accounts outside the U.S.
There's a form you declare it on. And if you don't declare it, you've already violated the law.
That's Gary Huffbauer, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
Evasion is much, much more extensive outside the United States. I know in India and much of Latin America, the tax system is regarded as something you avoid, not something you pay.
He estimates that the alleged Indian-American tax evasion could be worth hundreds of millions of dollars, but not billions. Still, he says the IRS's action is significant.
I think we're seeing a trend here, and I expect it to grow.
After successfully going after the Swiss bank UBS, the Internal Revenue Service is expected to target other international banks. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Did you see that scene in The Social Network where they're talking about what Facebook could be worth?
$1 million isn't cool. You know what's cool?
You?
$1 billion.
Well, Facebook's now valued as high as $75 billion, but it still hasn't gone public. As we've learned in recent months, shares of Facebook and other powerhouses like Twitter and Groupon are already being traded privately. There's currently a cap of 499 shareholders before a company has to open its financial books to the public. But the Securities and Exchange Commission confirmed today it's considering relaxing that rule. As Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith reports, that change could have big implications for investors.
Companies like to go public because selling shares is a great way to raise a lot of money. What they don't like are the costs. They have to disclose a lot of information and deal with regulations. Private companies are allowed to keep their secrets as long as they have fewer than 500 shareholders. The idea is that only a limited number of wealthy investors would get stung if the company isn't what they thought. Securities attorney Lance Kimmel says relaxing the shareholder cap is risky.
These policies were put in place as methods to protect the general public and ensure that they had accurate, verifiable information so that they could make a reasoned decision.
Take Facebook. Wealthy investors clamored for its private shares, sending its valuation soaring, says Kimmel.
I think the danger is that companies can continue to trade based on assumptions about whether they're doing well, hype, people who could start rumors.
Regulators have been under pressure to relax the rules to help startup companies raise money fast. But attorney Marvin Pickholtz with Duane Morris says making private shares more accessible undermines stock markets because it lets companies avoid going public.
I mean, it's almost like creating two markets, one for the so-called big boys and the others for everybody else to invest in.
Transactions of private shares nearly doubled last year to more than $4.5 billion. At the same time, the number of companies going public has been sliding. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
The latest job numbers are bringing some welcome news to the economy. The government's monthly report last week showed 216,000 workers were added to payrolls in March. And there's more positive news in the latest weekly report. The number of people filing for first-time jobless claims decreased again. Still, millions of Americans can't find work. So commentator Todd Buchholz has an idea for creating more jobs.
We all know we could use some hiring with a roughly 9% jobless rate. And that means encouraging more companies to hire workers. But there's a problem. Take a look at the healthcare legislation that just had its one-year anniversary. A firm with 50 or more employees must provide government-approved health insurance, or it can pay a fine. By the way, for businesses that already provide coverage, that fine looks enticing. Just $2,000 per worker. That's why some firms may end up choosing to voluntarily pay the penalty and dump their coverage and their workers onto the taxpayers. Accountants at AT&T told their bosses they could save nearly $1.8 billion by paying fines. But for small and growing businesses, the rule of 50 looks like a stumbling block, and it's a big one. Currently, we have about 6 million companies with fewer than 50 employees. Let's take a hypothetical case. Say you have 48 employees. Would you hire two more and risk stumbling across that line that says 50? Better to hire the part-timer. In this recovery, about 25% of the new jobs have been temporary. That's compared with 10% after the 1991 recession. A recent government report showed the number of job openings actually falling and five applicants wrestling over each job. No wonder millions of job seekers have given up. What can President Obama do? Surely the president doesn't like the high jobless rate. No one does. But he can take back the rule of 50 stumbling block. How? By turning it into an incentive for businesses to go out and hire people. Young, growing businesses create the bulk of our new jobs. The president should say, if you hire another employee, I will exempt you from my health care plan for another 5 years. That way, the rule of 50 can inspire job creation rather than stifling it.
Todd Buchholz worked for the first President Bush. He's author of the new book, Rush, Why You Need and Love the Rat Race. Got a comment? Send them to marketplace.org. Click on the contact link. 2011 has been a landmark year so far for U.S. businesses in China. Companies like GM and KFC have announced that for the first time, they've made more in China than they have back home. China's supersized marketplace hasn't been kind to all American businesses, though. Home Depot is closing stores. It recently shut its last Beijing store, the fifth Home Depot to close in China in the past 2 years. Why is the world's largest home improvement store underperforming in the world's fastest-growing property market? We sent our China correspondent Rob Schmitz to find out.
The Home Depot in the Chinese port city of Tianjin's got a huge paint counter near the entrance, stacks of lumber near the exit. Aisles of screws, fixtures, tools are in between. It looks exactly like a Home Depot in the U.S. And according to Tong Long, that's the problem.
Products are too cheap and simple at Home Depot. It's mainly for poor people.
Tong says poor people are the only people in China who would bother taking on a do-it-yourself home improvement project, who cannot afford to hire China's abundance of cheap labor to do it for them. Tong spent her life selling ceramic floor tiles at a building materials mall in Tianjin. She says China's culture isn't so much DIY, it's more DIFM, do it for me.
All my customers are designers. I never talk to homeowners. Homeowners in China hire designers for all their home improvement projects, even where to put a vase.
And when a designer buys tile from Tong, she gives them a cash bonus that goes straight to their wallet. This is the system the Home Depot is up against in China, where business depends on lifelong connections and under-the-table commissions. Home Depot boasts that it's the fastest-growing retailer in the U.S. It might be one of the slowest ones in China. In 5 years, it's gone from 12 stores to just 7.
I personally don't think like the act of opening stores or closing stores, that's really the only indicator of what we're doing well in China.
Raymond Chow heads the Home Depot's operations in China. Chow says the retailer has closed stores to focus on China's lesser-known cities, where much of the country's real estate development is booming.
The Home Depot is the world's largest home improvement specialty retailer in the world, I mean, by far, and we plan to be number one in China, too. Therefore, the task at hand is to figure out how do we become the largest home improvement retailer in China, whether or not they're going to be here or not.
I don't know that Home Depot needs to be here. I don't know if this is the right place for Home Depot.
Paul French is a retail analyst for Access Asia.
You can go around the ring roads of Beijing or you can go around the expressways of Shanghai and you see these giant warehouse places where manufacturers just set up inside and you go in there and there's 50 makes of toilet and 50 makes of power shower and 50 makes of bathroom tile. Everything's up for negotiation. You can sort everything out. It'll all get delivered. You don't need Home Depot.
Contractor Cho Changfeng may not need Home Depot, but he prefers it. He stands outside one of Tianjin's four Home Depot stores, happy with his purchase.
I come here all the time. It's easy to exchange and return goods here, and I know the materials here are safe and not fake.
And if there's anything that'll spell success for Home Depot in China, it'll be that, reliable products. Home Depot recently became the exclusive vendor of U.S.-made Behr paint. It's a strategic move in a market where paint, laden with chemicals harmful to your health, is the norm. But that's not enough to lure designer Cho Hongtao to Home Depot. He just bought flooring at a building materials mall down the street.
I've been to Home Depot, but I wasn't impressed. It's an American brand, and I went there expecting new and unique American products.
But Chiu says most of what Home Depot sells is stuff made in China. Who cares about that, he says, rolling his eyes. He can buy that anywhere. In Tianjin, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, a look back at the week's news, specifically at the stories that didn't quite make the headlines. Courtesy of Rico Galliano, Brendan Francis Noonan, and select members of the Marketplace staff.
Adrian Hill, sustainability reporter for Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, retailers around the country are gussying up their dressing rooms to make it more comfortable to those of us who spend time there.
So like wet bar, pedicure service?
Not quite, although it would be awesome. No, right now they're talking about things like improving the lighting, adding chandeliers. My question is, how far away are we from like those mirrors that could make you look really thin and attractive?
Again, I think this is where a wet bar could come in handy.
Stacey Vanek-Smith, New York reporter. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, Rico, here in New York on the Craigslist apartment listings, there's a new link for worst New York City landlords.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It has an interactive map, and it shows you where the landlords are, and it's the landlords who've had the most violations.
So is the entire map just like blood red with all the bazillions of landlords?
I'm telling you, there are no lack of bad landlords. And my theory is that this is going to become the new favorite website for cockroaches.
They're all emailing each other. It's like Party at 5th and Broadway.
Matt Berger, senior web developer for Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, the wholesale retailer Costco is getting into the diamond business.
Like the gumball machine, fake diamond ring business?
No, they're selling real diamond rings. They just announced that they have a $1 million ring for sale. And true to form, it's actually worth $1.6 million. You're just getting a discount because it's Costco.
That's incredible.
Yeah, but who's going to go to Costco to buy a diamond ring?
Probably someone like Larry King who like needs to buy in bulk.
You can hear more of what Brendan and Rico are serving up on their podcast. It's called The Dinner Party Download. And you can find a link on our website, marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 29 points, 0.25%. The Nasdaq dropped 15 points, or 0.5%. The S&P 500 dipped 5 points, 0.4%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yule. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, it's tax time, so you know what that means. Make sure your math is correct and you've got all the forms you need. Otherwise...
The first time I was audited, I just really did not have good records. It wasn't pretty, and that for sure was a terrifying experience.
I'm Bob Moon. Thanks again for being with us this week. Hope you can join Kai back here on Monday. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.